War doesn't end when you leave the battlefield. The hardest fight comes after service. Identity, purpose, and tribe. Where do you stand when the uniform comes off? This is where we talk about it. No bullshit, no filters, just real stories from those who've been through it. This is the Great Guns Podcast with your host, James Scott.
Hello, everyone. It's James again from the Great Guns Podcast. And on today's episode, we have Dave Watson, who previously was in the Army, then Metropolitan Police, and then has been involved in charities and fostering and so on. But we'll get into all of that. So without further ado, over to David. How are you?
Yeah, fine. Thanks, James. Nice to see you. And happy to chat about my experiences, if it helps someone.
Yes, great. Yeah. So kind of just to kick off with, it might sound a bit strange, but from, if you like, battlefields to buffet, you've worked with, like I said previously, with the police force, you were in the Army, did fostering, and now you're running a B&B up north. Are you just trying to collect job titles and medals, or what's the rationale behind that?
Good question, actually. A lot of people queried when we went into fostering. People didn't query why I joined the Army or the police, but more about fostering. And then obviously when we finished fostering and starting a B&B, I had a lot more people saying, why do the change? But from a very young age, and I think I got it from my mum's side, my mum used to work in home help for 30 odd years and looking after old people. And I think I have that gene because when I joined the Army, I wanted to be a policeman. Before I joined the Army, I, you know, naively help people and catch baddies. And I joined Army Cadets and went to Germany on a plane for the first time. And I come from a village in the middle of Northumberland and loved the Army Cadets. And I thought I could combine the two and become a military policeman. However, I was had over when I went for my 2-day selection at Harrogate. And they said, join the Coldstream Guards. And once you've done 3 years, you can transfer in the military to the military police. But actually, we had good postings in the Coldstream Guards and 2 years in Hong Kong. And when I came back from Hong Kong, we were based in Wellington Barracks, central London. And it was at that point, I'd done about 9 years. And it was either I stay in the Army for the rest of my career or join the police. And the Metropolitan Police recruitment office was round the corner at Scotland Yard. And I went in there and unfortunately, I didn't have an exemplary from the Army. I had a very good, got into an altercation when I was in the Army. But I told the recruitment officer that and told him everything. And he says, well, go and do some sort of charity work. Come back and see us in 6 months' time. So I ended up doing, working on a ward at Westminster Hospital. It's not there anymore. It's a block of flats. And befriended this old woman who was a nanny. And she tried to commit suicide and jump out of a window and impale both her legs on iron railings. Basically, the family's kids she was looking after didn't need her anymore. And she was in hospital for a long time. So I befriended her quite a lot and chatted to her. And me and this nurse, we got her out of the hospital for the day. And because I was Coldstream Guards, we did Troop in the Colour and Buckingham Palace and that. And I got her into Buckingham Palace forecourt to watch Changing of the Guard. She, you know, it was really nice. But charity work for that and got into the Metropolitan Police. Did 26 years, being battered, bruised, some near misses. I'm very fortunate to be here.
Just on that. I know you obviously some of the background information you sent me was about the stabbing. I mean, that's quite something, quite close call.
Yeah, it was. And I was very, very fortunate. I was in the CID at the time, so I wasn't uniform. And I wasn't wearing body armour. In fact, body armour just literally started coming in. To be mandatory, all firearms officers in the police had to wear them, but ballistic uniform, we didn't have to at that time. It was literally coming in as mandatory. But it was a gentleman who had mental health issues and decided to set his neighbour's house on fire by putting a tie against his front door. And his front door was the only escape to his house because it was on the 17th floor of a block of flats. Wow. And managed to track him down and he come at me with a knife and sod's law, my baton was on me left side and not me right, and I couldn't get it out in time. I was by myself, and I was sort of cornered, really, and he kept coming at me with a knife, and I just knew he was going to stab me, and I literally twisted my body to protect my chest and vital organs, lungs, etc. Yeah. And as I twisted my body to protect, as he was lunging towards me, the blade went into my shoulder, and it was so hard it broke the blade. And and he kept coming at me, and I can't remember much after that, if I'm honest, but all I remember then was he was running off, and you know, I started chasing him, and bear in mind I was in a suit, and because I was running, the blood was pumping around my body, so I was literally spurting out of where I'd been stabbed. So by the time the ambulance crew turned up and everyone, it looked a lot worse than what it was. I mean, my shirt was soaked. But it was interesting. They talk about shock, and it felt like you were sort of looking in into an experience. Like, it was like an out-of-body experience, sorry. And and I remember being in the back of the ambulance, and I can hear everyone talking. I was conscious. I was talking. But it wasn't. It was like everything was in slow motion. It was clearly I was in shock. Loss of blood.
Yeah.
Obviously, I didn't know that at the time. And, you know, we talk a lot in the forces about dark humor, banter, including the police. Probably not so much of it now, but
yeah, I remember. Quite a bit.
Yeah, I remember the ambulance crew, and it's a distraction technique. Mentioned I was a bit chubby, and yeah, but I can't remember much. Although I was conscious throughout, it was a bit of a blur. I remember going to the hospital, and I remember at the hospital the doctor saying he was worried about infection more than the actual cut itself or the stabbing, because obviously infection you can die from.
Yeah.
And he was going to put me under, then change his mind. And yeah, I was stitched up. But they took all my clothes for forensics. So when they came to collect me, the lads from the office came to collect me, I had no clothes. So they all brought bits and bobs of clothes. So again, humour, albeit I wasn't fully conscious or fully aware of my surroundings. They brought their tightest white t-shirt.
Yeah.
Came motorbike boots, tight bloody pink shorts. And I put these on to walk through A&E to go, you know, get a lift back to the station. But that was how we dealt with it then. And it was it was when the bombs were going off in London. And so I had 2 weeks off work, and I could have had a lot more, but I didn't. So I wanted to get back to work. But it was interesting when the first week I didn't want to go out the house. And the second week I sort of forced myself to go out. But anyone who got really close to me, I don't know what they call it, but I got really anxious. I was really, my senses were heightened. So yeah. Anyone got close to me, I was really like fully aware of, you know, really never experienced that before.
What did you do then to kind of overcome that then? How did you get past that? Because that's quite something.
I think it was probably not focusing on it too much and just being aware of it. And just getting on with stuff, probably not the best way of dealing with it. My boss at the time said, you know, you've got to have counselling before you come back. I mean, they can't force you to have counselling, but I just did what he did. But because of the bombings, counselling was didn't have a lot of counsellors, but they're so busy because of the bombings. And I remember me going for an hour's counselling. And, you know, before then, it was just going to the pub afterwards and talking about it, and that's how you dealt with it. There was counselling, you know, just offloading. But I remember the counsellor looking at the clock on the wall, and I'll never forget that, because to me he wasn't listening, but he's probably so busy looking to make sure that he's going to be ready for the next person. And and I'd done a bit of counselling because I did volunteer work for Childline. And so although not professional counsellor, you know, you're sort of instructed or taught on how to listen and blah, blah, blah. But yeah, so for me, it was not a great experience, but I ticked that box so I could get back to work. And I think also when my mum died, I was in the police and I remember going back to work too early, but I just wanted to keep busy. And I'll never forget, I was on patrol because I was 2 or 10 shift in uniform and I was walking through the park in Bethnal Green. It's about 9 o'clock at night by myself and it just hit us. I just burst into tears. Don't know why. I sat down in the park bench, helmet off, bear in mind I'm in full uniform. Immediately it was dark. And literally 10 minutes later, a superintendent and a sergeant walked past. They'd just been to a neighbourhood watch meeting. And they didn't see me upset because it was dark. And I quickly got up and chatted to them and got on. But I think it reminds me of when you don't deal with stuff and you sort of put it, you know, you put it away and you just get on with stuff. If you don't deal with it properly, it will hit you. And I think, you know, chatting to lads when we're in Northern Ireland and things happened in Northern Ireland, you know, in chatting about them, I think that's so important. But I know when I left and a few others left, people found it a struggle not to have that sense of purpose. I was very fortunate because when I left the army after 9 years, I had 2 months off, then I went straight into the police.
Yeah, so you kept that continuity almost.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, it was the Hendon Training Centre, which they don't have residential training, police training centres now. So you were there for 6 months. And again, it was sort of, you know, you're working, you're there, you know, Monday to Friday, and it's residential. And you're studying with other people. Again, it's uniform. Our uniform was disciplined. There was discipline there. There was a routine there. So that was quite an easy transition for me. And also with being in Northern Ireland, with stop and search and talking to people, you know, in Northern Ireland and that, you know, I think that helps you, you know, dealing with members of the public as a police officer, because you don't have to be, you know, they talk about having a degree to be a police officer. I totally disagree with that. Because a lot of what you do as a police officer is communication skills and dealing with members of the public.
Yeah.
Yes, you do need to know the law, but I didn't have a degree and a lot of people I work with didn't have degrees, but we still had to do the training and pass the exams. But without a doubt, my army service gave me that discipline and my work ethos, because I saw people coming into the police I was working with that, you know, wanted to get away early or didn't want to answer a particular call or, you know, and that frustrated me. And I think also it gave me the confidence to tell people how it is as well. And some people don't like to hear the truth. But, you know, I retired from the police. Yeah, I've been beaten up, almost lost an eye. We were, stop this drink driver. He was 6 foot, this bloke. He's a big old bloke. And it was in the summer, and he was sweating anything. We're trying to get the handcuffs on. And the front passenger, we thought was his girlfriend, but at the time, I know now, she was a prostitute and he was a pimp. And we were on the floor trying to get the cuffs on him, and it was like rolling around me and this other police officer. And we couldn't get the cuffs on him, and next thing I know, she ran and literally launched and kicked out. Then I got kicked just under my right eyebrow, again knocked out. I can't remember anything after that. And I woke up in hospital and had 3 or 4 stitches, but if she'd been like a millimeter lower, I would have lost my eye. So yeah, I was quite lucky there.
How, like, you've spoken about like going through those sort of scenarios and things, and then you mentioned about kind of your work ethos being kind of bred into you through being in the army and then coming into the police force, for example, and then seeing people not doing things and frustrating you. How did you deal with that? How, like, when you go home, what did you do to kind of not allow that to boil up? Because I know some people can keep it in, and with everything piling on top, suddenly it just becomes this massive eruption, and then, you know, all bets are off. Like, what was it that you did particularly, or that you kind of remember that you did?
I think to deal with it. I was always honest with people, and sometimes, you know, you gauge people, don't you? And you don't sort of, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? You don't embarrass them in front of other people.
Yeah.
Or shame them, they call it, sorry, shaming, which is what they use in fostering. Shaming is quite significant. You know, you take people aside and, you know, you try and work with them. But actually, when you work in a team, is close-knit because some of the situations you deal with, and I'm not joking you, are life-threatening, and that bonds you, and you're not fully aware of it. But looking back and reflecting, that absolutely, some of the things we dealt with, you know, Bishopsgate bombing, we were clearing people away from that. You know, I've been at house fires where we pulled people out of a burning house.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of road traffic accidents where people are literally dying and you're doing first aid on them. And it's all that sort of dark shit that, you know, you don't meet very nice people in, you know, in the police.
No, police, yeah, it's all, you're meeting the ones that are needing the police to take, sort them out. So, yeah.
Absolutely. But I think it's just, I mean, we did spend a lot of time in the pub, I won't lie to you, after work. And I remember when I first joined the police, they had what they call police section houses. So again, it was very sort of similar to, not like it, it was like, it was a big building. You had your own room, but communal, you know, ablutions. So it was very similar to the army. So the problem with that was if you're like on a 6 till 2 shift and you think, oh, I'm going to go to bed early, and somebody be banging on your door at 6 o'clock in the afternoon saying, come on, let's go out for a couple of beers. Well, you couldn't have a couple of beers, and you know, you're there at 11 o'clock, but you're back at work, you know, for 6. But it was that sort of peer pressure of living in a section house. But actually, you know, it was good times because you had to not offload, but you had to decompress. Because otherwise, if you constantly deal with all the traumatic things we dealt with, you'd end up on the, you know, as a vegetable on the ground wibbling.
Yeah.
But thoroughly enjoyed the army. You know, it was difficult at times, but it definitely, you know, it definitely helped me throughout life. And, you know, we've sort of briefly talked about fostering. Well, fostering, without a doubt, has been the hardest thing I've ever done. It's not physical work, it's emotional. Now, I fostered teenagers for 10 years, and a lot of them are dysregulated because of what's happened to them.
Yeah, they must bring a lot of emotion with them as well into your own environment to deal with.
Yeah, and They basically throw, they call it sabotage. So anything good in their lives, they will sabotage, and they will throw as much crap at you for, they call it a placement. So when you get a young person to come and stay with you, or for you to look after them, call it a placement. And they try and break that placement so that it reinforces they're not good and not a good person. So it's very difficult to, when they throw in all the crap at you, screaming and shouting, smashing up the bedrooms, running away, you're looking for them at 2 o'clock in the morning. You know, it can have that emotional impact on you. It's quite tiring as you get older, but you've just got to hang in there because they will turn a corner at some stage, or majority of them will. Not, you can't capture them all.
Yeah.
And also, yeah, I mean, you do courses with fostering about sort of, you know, unacceptable behavior or challenging behavior, and COVID hasn't helped the youngsters, but I think it's just being there, you know, so when they're having a shit day, which is virtually every day, they're just offloading and you've just got to be there to try and pick up the pieces. But sometimes it can be quite stressful. And if you're dealing with that on a daily basis, and bear in mind, fostering is your home, is your workplace in effect.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's always there.
Although, you don't see fostering as work, but it is in a way, but it's so you don't get an escape from it, if that makes sense.
So how do you get an escape then? Because you have to, we as humans, we have to have kind of quiet time, if you like, or moments away. What do you do? Because it's right there in your home.
Yeah, so they talk about self-help and make sure you look after yourself a lot in fostering. They didn't when I first started, but they do it quite a lot now. But when I went through the recruitment process, they make a big emphasis on your family, your support structure. And of course, I didn't have a mum and dad. They passed away. Lucy's mum and dad were quite sort of elderly. We had friends, but no, my family close by. But we had a couple of foster carers who were friends of ours, and we got to know them and their kids. So sometimes we would work together, and like, if we wanted get a weekend away, we would say to the other foster carer, could you look after such and such for us just for a couple of days? And we get it okayed with a social worker, and we do the same for them. So you know, when we first started and they talked about respite, it was like, no, we're, you know, going away, we'll take whoever we've got. But actually, it's important to have that respite. And also with fostering, and, you know, I do wonder if they should do it in the army, really, but you have support groups, so where you meet sort of every 6 weeks. So there'll be a male foster support group, or there'll be a teenager support group, or baby and mother support group. And you go to these meetings, it's only a couple of hours, coffee and a chat offload. It's quite interesting because you hear other foster carers talk about who they're looking after and how they deal with certain things. And that builds up your knowledge of looking after dysregulated kids, because what might work for you might not work for someone else.
Yeah, very much so.
So that you know, that support group is quite, you know, don't get me wrong, it's not fluffy. It's you know, we say it how it is, you know. And
so is that your kind of advice then, is say it as it is and get support and talk to people about whatever's going on?
Yeah, I mean,
my next question to you is going to be, like, if you were a person stuck, whether you're a veteran or someone else, and you're kind of stuck and you're lost, what would your advice be to them? So it kind of leads into it, you know.
Yeah, that you've got to ask for help, basically. You really have. And I know as men and people in the army, you know, that's a sign of weakness, and I get that, totally get that. I know a lot of people talk about mental health, and sometimes I do think sometimes you talk about it too much, as in it's, you know, we all talk about anxiety and stuff like that. I think an element of anxiety is good for you, and stress, an element of stress is good for you, yeah, as well. But it's that's what builds your resilience, I think, and your life experiences, builds you who you are as you get older, obviously.
Yeah.
And I think the younger generation coming through are getting less experiences. You know, I remember, you know, delivering milk and delivering papers when I was 9, 10
years old.
Yeah, the good old
paper rounds.
Yeah,
9, 10
years old. So I started very young, getting pocket money by doing stuff, whereas now legally they can't do stuff like that at a certain age.
Yeah, I think like when you're 16, you can only work, I think it's 4 hours, and then you have to have a half an hour break, and, you know, they're very regimented and restricted.
Yeah. And I remember one of the boys, and this just I was looking after, and he started at college, full-time college this is. So in his head, full-time college. So he goes to college 3.5 days a week. So in his head, full-time is 3.5 days a week.
3.5 hours. Yeah, so, 2 days, yeah.
We're setting him up to fail. So when he goes for a job and they're like, right, you've applied for this full-time job, in his head, he's thinking 3.5 days. It's just, you know, it's...
That reminds me of, something I saw was, I don't know whether it's like kids of today or the generation of today, if they applied for a job that meant they could sleep, they'd still wake up and complain about it. So it is that they're just, their expectations are so different from...
Yeah.
What we had.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. And I know we've got to change and move on with the times, and I get that. And, you know, we talk about mental health, and especially in the armed forces, is, you know, it's, you know, I was in a barrack room with probably 10, 12 lads, and we had a bed space that was just a bed and a locker, and that was it. Mm-hmm. And you'd have two or three lads down the bottom of the room watching TV in the evenings, or you have two or three lads having a drink, playing cards, or you'd have some lads going out for a drink. So there was always that, you had people around you, you know, to chat and talk bollocks, basically. Whereas I think now a lot of their accommodation, I think, is it SLAM they call it? Single living?
Yeah. They've got a lot more, it's like a whole room with, on their own, where they don't, they're not together, yeah.
Yeah, it's like a room with an ensuite. And I think, I mean, even in Wellington Barracks, I think we had rooms of four, which was okay, because you still had that interaction. You know, you had the choice of if someone's going out or if you just wanted to watch TV. You always had someone there.
Yeah. And even if you weren't chatting and interacting, there's still that person. You're not alone.
Yeah. Yeah. Whereas now, I think they just go into their accommodation, shut the door and go on social media, which isn't healthy. You know,
no.
And a lot of the problems I dealt with in fostering teenagers was all, a lot of it was all around social media and, you know, the effects on them
yeah.
in a negative way. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause they forget that what they see on social media is someone posing effectively, going, look how great my life is. Oh, look what I'm doing. But meantime, they can be feeling exactly the same as you, the viewer. And I think a lot of the time people get lost in that. They don't realize it. And I sometimes wonder when, like, you hear of veteran suicides and that, and you think, is it part of that? They've been scrolling and going, my mate so-and-so that I was with, you know, look how well he's doing. Oh, look at this one. Look how well they're doing. But they're fighting their own battles, but you won't know it because you just see this perfect little image on, I don't know, one of the platforms, Facebook, Instagram, whatever it is. So I can believe it's with the younger lot. That must be a massive influence on them.
Yeah, and they tend to believe everything they see on social media, which is a worry as well.
Yeah.
And the thing is, you know, I was brought up as a kid, you know, climbing trees and, you know, making me own fun. I wasn't brought up with phones, and it's a different generation. You know, as foster carers, we had to sort of catch up about social media and technology, because you can't just keep saying no, because that you've got to work with it. Because, you know, it's the amount of sexual exploitation on phones is just, it's just rife. And then when I was sort of army cadets, I was, you know, when we take the kids away for weekends and that.
Yeah.
Because I was quite surprised talking, you know, girls would complain about dick pics and stuff like that. And a lot of the kids didn't quite understand, you know, taking a picture of the dick and then sending it to someone is, you know, distributing pornographic material, which is a criminal offence. And so I was in the police at the time. So I would give just chats just to make them aware of that. Because if you go to certain countries and you've got a caution or conviction for certain offences, including like Class A drug, you might not get a visa to go into certain countries. And the bigger pictures, they don't think like that. They just live in the moment, you know, not blaming them, because I remember when I was young, I wasn't thinking what was I going to do when I was 30. I was just living in the moment and enjoying myself.
Well, we weren't recording our lives then as well. So, you know.
Absolutely.
And yeah, there wasn't someone in your...
That was the other thing, you know, you'd sort of support mentoring because of your experiences and, you know, letting them know they were putting everything, what they did every day on the web, you know, and once it's on there, you can't get rid of it, you know, and again, the bigger picture is if you're going for a job and you put some stupid comments on social media, there are companies out there that will scrutinize your social media and make a report to, you know, your future employee.
Yeah.
And again, you know, just things like that they weren't aware of. But But I do think, you know, all my sort of, even though I came from a village in Northumberland and there wasn't a lot going on, I built my sort of experience of life definitely within the army. You know, I had some fantastic experiences and spent a lot of time abroad, and which helped me, you know, in the police and dealing with people. And then without a doubt, fostering teenagers was the hardest thing I've ever done.
What a challenge. As I say, that like you've had quite a few, you know, like frontline roles. I mean, you're talking about Ireland, so you were out on patrol on the streets there. And then obviously with the Metropolitan Police, you were obviously out on patrol and seeing some of the worst things out there. But then like you didn't put your feet up after leaving that. You kind of were involved. I know you were heavily involved in the cadets and fostering and that sort of thing. What like drove you to do all of that? Like you didn't just go, right, I've done my bit and put your feet up. And then what lessons has that kind of taught you?
Yeah, I think I got interested into fostering because towards the end of my career, when I was working in CID, one of our remits was to deal with high risk missing people. And a lot of high risk missing people were kids in care. So I met a lot of foster carers and social workers around that, and that quite interested me. So when it came to retiring, my wife was still working. You know, there was no way I could just stop and put my feet up and do nothing because, again, you know, one of the things that was highlighted when I was at Hendon, they say the first 5 years of your retirement is you're more prone to get a heart attack.
Yeah.
Because you're constantly doing shift work, you're constantly active, then all of a sudden you stop. But I wasn't necessarily thinking about that, but it did involve, not play on my mind, but it was in the back of my head.
Yeah, it was there.
Yeah. But also, because of my army service, was carried over. It was only 4 years of it, was carried over into the police. So I did 26, 27 years in the police. So I was 50 when I retired, which is nothing. And you've got to have a sense of purpose, because if you don't have a sense of purpose, you lose your way. And when I first left the police, and I worked in a very busy office, phones never stopped. You know, we were out on the street dealing with stabbings, shootings. So it was very busy. So I've gone from that to, you know, my workplace being at home and looking after teenagers and seeing an adult stroke social worker once every 6 weeks. So I had to quickly adapt to that sudden change, which I did struggle with. I won't lie to you. I really sort of, you know, have I made the right decision resigning? And it was when they were also, I think a couple of years after I resigned, I got a letter asking to go back because they wanted more experienced detective sergeants. But I did go back. Yeah. But the police service has changed dramatically, you know, and with dealing with, you know, tough stuff, is that dark humour, black humour, whatever you want to call it. And people don't want to necessarily like it. In fostering, you know, you had to have a sense of humour, because if you didn't, you would crumble. And sometimes that sense of humour is dark. And, you know, I'm not saying all social workers, but some social workers could be offended or by some of the language you use. That was your way of dealing with it. And I think when people haven't been in, experience what you've gone through, it's all right for them to say, oh, you can't say stuff like that. But you can, you know, as long as you're not, you know, directly upsetting someone or shaming them, but you have to have a sense of humour.
Yeah, I think it's our human natural response, isn't it, to work through things, is you have that dark sense of humour. And I think, you know, you hear it all the time. People in job roles like the police, the army, paramedics, fire, you know, all of those that have got that, where they see the really awful side of life. That's how they get through it. But it doesn't make it necessarily right. But it, like you say, as long as you're not shaming someone in specific and, you know, aiming it at any one person or one group, I think you're all right. As long as, you know, it helps. I mean, that's all you can do.
Yeah. And I think, you know, well, my boss was, when I was fostering, was a social worker, and she got it. And if I went on courses where there were other foster carers as social workers, she would sort of just be mindful of what you say. But of course, being a northerner as well, we do tend to say how it is, you know. And, you know, sometimes, don't get me wrong, I've said stuff and I think, oh, crikey me, I shouldn't have maybe have said that. But there is a big north-south divide when it comes to things like that, I think, and from my experience.
Yeah, you know. Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree.
Yeah, it's people can be easily offended or want to be easily offended. But at the end of the day, if you've been through something traumatic or you're dealing with something, and the only way you can deal with it is through that humour, then they should respect that. But then you've got to be mindful of their feelings as well.
Yeah, sure. So I'm actually a southerner, but my family's from up north, but I get the northern humour, and I think there is quite that divide. I think, don't know, people say life is tougher up north. So maybe, you know, if you have a tough life, you tend to be drawn more to that kind of say it as it is and have a laugh about it.
Possibly. Don't know. Yeah.
But you did surprise me with your sense of humour on the shooting range. You came up with a comment and I was like, didn't expect that from you. It wasn't anything rude, but it was just, I'm not going to repeat it, but it was just a bit funny. Because I didn't expect that sense of humour from you, because of the way you carried yourself at the time. I mean, I didn't know you that long. But yeah, I thought that was really funny. And then I saw a different side to you. I was like, oh, okay. Actually, he's all right.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to, it's difficult not to take life too seriously, because, you know, in the police, I had a couple of mates, you know, were killed on duty. You know, Nina, she was stabbed to death, bless her. And she, you know, you talk about fate, she swapped shifts with another officer. And hadn't she done, she'd be alive today.
Yeah, it's sad, that.
But, you know, it's a mate killed in a motorbike crash, you know, and it sort of brings it life can be too short, you know. And I don't know how to explain it, but
just say, live in the moment and just not, like you said earlier, not take it too seriously.
Yeah. But of course, you know, people haven't always had, you know, got them experiences, and so sometimes don't understand, you know, why you use that particular humour or dark humour. But it's so important, I think.
I agree. But like you were saying as well, like if sometimes people don't know what you've been through, and so they don't know understand why you might use that humour. But it's also things I've noticed with conversations with people, because I've lived elsewhere as well. Mm. People will say things, and you're like, "It's not like that." You've got no idea, but they will judge you because you might have said something.
Mm.
But had they had the same experience as you where you lived, and they might go, "Oh, okay, now I understand." So, yeah, I think that's a good life lesson. Is sometimes just stop and think. You might not agree with someone, or you might not appreciate their humor, for example, because we're talking about humor. But just stop and think. Well, hang on, maybe there's more to it than I'm seeing or hearing. So I think that's a good lesson.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I mean, you know, it's like when you go on annual camp for 2 weeks with, you know, 200-300 kids, and how exhausting that is. I mean, it's when I come back from annual camp for 2 weeks, it doesn't speak to me for 2 days, because it's just like being jet lagged. It's just, it's bizarre, because you're just lack of sleep, and you've been constantly on the go, and you've had teenagers constantly badgering you all the time. But for me, that was such a different type of stress release from what I was doing in the police. You know, it was totally different.
Mm.
And it was a good stress buster for me. I mean, I did a lot of fitness, and I think fitness is really important, you know, and to sort of keep your sort of mind. I got a bike over COVID, and it got me out of the house. So I was cycling on the South Downs, and that helped, because you imagine COVID, and you've got teenagers you're looking after, and they can't go out, and it's just World War III in your house all the time. But yeah, I think fitness is so important. But you know, I haven't been to one, but they do a lot of veteran breakfast clubs, and I think that's good. But
yeah, I've seen quite a few of those around.
Locally. Yeah.
It's good.
Yeah. But I don't know now, when you leave the army, if you get debriefed, like a debrief interview, because we were trying to encourage people to be debriefed and say, look, there's the army cadets there for voluntary work if you want to do it. But of course, a lot of people leave the army, tend to go into a second job, or they need to go into a second job.
Mm.
So sometimes that voluntary isn't on their radar as such.
Yeah, I think just having spoken to quite a few guys as well, the experience leaving is very different. I think it's almost like you spoke earlier, you wanted to maybe thinking about going into the police when you were going in the army. And then let me guess, your recruitment officer, NCO, was probably from the Coldstream Guard. So that's why you then get, oh, yeah, no, sign up with us, and then you can transfer. I think it all just depends on who you've got, as to what they will give you. Because, yeah, I mean, chat we were talking about earlier, John, he said to me, literally got back when he left, and it was some young lad came, you know, he had to hand his kit over because his unit was no longer, but he didn't come back with the rest of them because they had reshuffled. So he was literally just, man, here you go, there's your kit, bye, done. Mm-hmm. So he obviously felt quite alone, where others, I know a couple who are ex-RAF, very different experience, in their leaving process, and they are just smashing it because of how they were treated when they left. So I think like you were saying, that debrief and stuff, I think that's would be great if everybody was treated in the same way. I think it would be very important.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
But
I'm just going to say, we're coming up to kind of nearly an hour almost. Going forward, what are you up to then?
Come forward. So, yeah, I'm 60, not ready to do nothing. So, we're running a B&B up north on Hadrian's Wall, and we look to open up in April, and it's predominantly for walkers. And that'd be good to meet people from all around the world. We've got a lot of Dutch coming, and we're at the start or the finish at Hadrian's Wall, and we're only doing it for 6 months, but it'll be hard graft for 6 months, but then we've got 6 months off, so it's a good sort of work balance, as it were. And Lucy's sort of retired from the NHS, which means we'll be working together, and it's a project that we're both, you know, looking to do.
You get one together?
I have spoke to people who work with their other halves, and you get different
Mine is happy to work with mine. We get on well. And that's not because she's close by and can hear me, but it genuinely is. I wouldn't have it any other way. So there's another positive for you.
Yeah, no. And that we're both sort of excited, but a little bit apprehensive. I'm not going to lie, because it's something we've never done before. Albeit when we did emergency fostering, you know, the police or social services would bring someone round at 2 o'clock in the morning and you'd be looking after them. You don't even know case studies about them at all, and they were sort of dumped on you for 2 weeks and you had to look after them. So in a way, it's again, you know, because people say to me, oh, what's it like having strangers in your house? Well, it's at the end of the day, your house is a house, isn't it? You know, if it gets damaged, it gets damaged, so what? But it's just making, you know, looking after people and making them welcome, and being kind, you know. Doesn't cost anything to be kind.
No, it doesn't.
Yeah.
So it doesn't. One last thing I did want to ask you, would you, just if you look back on everything, would you do it all again? Talking about your work. I don't want to get you into trouble.
No. I mean, of course, you know, when you're in the army, you tend to think of, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning, bottom of a trench in Thetford, someone's waking you up and it, you know, you're on stag and you're getting out your bivvy bag and it's freezing. Them times, and you're thinking, what the hell am I doing? But no, absolutely not. You know, I've been very fortunate. I've been all around the world with the armed forces, and I've seen things. I've met people in the police and seen things I would never have done. I've met people, you know, kids in fostering that have enhanced my life from their experiences and what they've taught me. And I think it's all about reflecting and how you can do things better as well. You know, because no one's perfect. And if someone says they are perfect, well,
yeah,
you know, they're not telling the truth. But I don't, you know, there's nothing I don't regret. My worry is for the younger generation not having the experiences and opportunities, which is why Army Cadets for me was great, because we give cadets opportunities that normal other kids wouldn't get the chance to do.
Yeah.
And I do worry, you know, with funding and stuff like that, you know, the Army Cadets will be at the bottom of the pile when it comes to funding. But we've got to be realistic as well.
Yeah. It would say to, I mean, I'd say to parents and people, it doesn't matter which cadet force the kid goes to, Army, Navy, Air, doesn't matter. All of them, I think, offer such a fantastic experience for them. Like you're saying, there's things there they will do that they'll never learn and see elsewhere. But it builds them, builds their character. I think it's fantastic. It'd be sad to see anything get cut back so far that they just can't put it on anymore.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Dave, thanks very much. I really enjoyed it, but I've always enjoyed having chats with you anyway. So thank you. I do appreciate it. Wish you the best of luck with the B&B and really do hope that goes well. And maybe one day we'll catch you up there on Hadrian's Wall Hadrian's Wall. I have walked it once or twice with cadets.
Yeah.
So I do know it. Yeah. So thanks very much. And we'll chat soon.
Yeah. And good luck with your hair transplant.
Thanks a lot.
Keep your sense of humor.
Always, always will. Cheers.
Take care, James. All the best, mate.
That's a wrap, folks. And a big thank you to our guest. Remember, keep moving forward. The fight's not over until you decide it is. Till next time, stay bold, stay fearless. Live life like it's too short for half measures. This is the Great Guns Podcast, signing off. And remember to subscribe to join our tribe.